From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It's been called the greatest feat of exploration since Columbus discovered America, that day nearly 19 years ago when man first walked on the moon. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with one of the Apollo 11 astronauts, Michael Collins. He's just written a history of the space program called Liftoff. Also today, we speak with Ron Shelton. He never made it out of the minor leagues as a baseball player, but he does have a major league hit with his new movie, Bull Durham, which he wrote and directed. Not every woman in rock music is a sensitive poet or a leather-clad biker. Rock critic Ken Tucker has three examples. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Who Framed Roger Rabbit. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. While Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon on July 20th, 1969, my guest Michael Collins was orbiting in the Apollo 11 command capsule, waiting to take Armstrong and Aldrin back to Earth. 3 years before, Collins piloted Gemini 10 and walked in space, attached to his spacecraft only by a high-tech umbilical cord. After he retired from the space program in 1970, Collins briefly worked as Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, a position he described as a plush purgatory. He felt more fulfilled in his next job as director of the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. Michael Collins has written a new book about the U.S. space program called Liftoff. His previous book, Carrying the Fire, was an autobiography that became a bestseller. I spoke with Collins from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. He has witnessed the Earth and the Moon from a perspective few others have shared. I asked him if he feels a responsibility to describe it to the rest of us.
Well, I think it's important to write those things down. I think sometime 50 years from now, people will say, I wonder what it was like now that flying in space is so routine. I wonder what it was like back then when it was not routine. How did it impress those who first went up to the moon and looked back on Earth? I think it's, I'm not sure it's important, but I think it's kind of fun to write those things down.
In the very beginning of your new book, Liftoff, you describe how it feels when a technician snaps the helmet down into the neck ring. Would you describe that for us?
Well, that's when you sort of say goodbye to the world, because even though you're still on the surface, you can no longer smell or really touch or even hear something unless it's electronically piped in. So when that neck ring goes click, click and locks into place, you're hermetically sealed and your space voyage has really begun then, even though you're still standing on the ground.
Is it a good feeling or a terrible feeling?
It's neither. It's sort of like shifting gears in an automobile, I guess. I'm not sure third gear is better than a second or worse, but it's a definite break, a definite change, and you feel that you're into something entirely new and different. Neither better nor worse, just different.
When you were strapped down in July of 1969, waiting to head for the moon, and you heard the countdown, what were you thinking about when you heard the countdown?
I don't like countdowns. I don't like, I think you're nervous enough without someone yelling in your ear, 10, 9, 8, 7. I think what they ought to do instead of having those backwards numbers is have someone with a sweet voice like yours, Terry, say, hey, I think it's about time to go.
No, are you serious about that? I mean, would you really... I can't tell if that's just what you're saying or if you really think that they should change that because the countdown causes a lot of extra attention for the astronauts.
No. I'm kidding. But to be serious, I think it's totally unnecessary as far as the crew's concerned to tell them every last second preceding. I mean, we know we have a clock right there in front of us. We know pretty much when the thing is going to go. But it's a small point that either way they want to do it is fine with me.
I'm really interested in the sensation of taking off. I'm thinking just when you go up in an airplane, your ears lock. What happens to your body when you're propelled into space at this incredibly high velocity?
Well, the motors are very, very powerful, but they're lifting a gigantic weight so that when you first leave the launch pad, and you can see this on your television screen, the thing doesn't you know, disappear instantly. It's a very slow and stately ride at the beginning. Then the thing is that the engines keep churning away at full speed, and the fuel tanks begin to empty, so that the weight is decreasing, the power remains the same, and then you really begin to accelerate. It's as if a giant hand were pushed down on your chest, and you find it very difficult to move. You can't really move your arms or legs very well, and even your breathing gets a little bit forced.
When you were heading toward the moon, it was Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin who were going to walk on the moon, and you were going to be in the control room circling the moon as they did their walk. Why was it you who was chosen to stay in the command capsule?
Gee, that's something that evolved over a long period of time. I became a specialist in the mothership, the command module. Aldrin had been an expert in rendezvous, and Neil Armstrong was the most experienced test pilot among our astronaut group. So these sort of specialized skills of ours, the three of us fit together nicely, but it was something that developed over a long period of time. It wasn't that all of a sudden one Friday morning someone said, you, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do that, and you're going to do the other.
When you were alone in the capsule and they had taken off, what happened? Did two capsules break apart so that they could go to the moon while you stayed where you were?
Yes, that's right. The machines were quite specialized. The one that I was in, which was called Columbia, was the base camp, you might say. And the one that made the final approach and landing was called Eagle. And it was a specialized machine, had two parts. The bottom half of it, which had the landing gear, stayed on the surface of the moon, is still there, and it acted sort of as a launch pad for the top half. The top half blasted off from the surface of the moon, came back up and found me in orbit overhead. And then we just jettisoned, left old Eagle in orbit around the moon, and the three of us came home in Columbia.
Now, you confess in your new book that your big fear when you were alone in the command capsule was that you wouldn't be able to make contact with the other astronauts and you'd have to leave without them.
Well, that's certainly true. I think a trip to the moon and back is a long and fragile chain of events. I think of it almost as a daisy chain. Any one link in that chain can break the entire sequence. But of all the links, the one that clearly to me was the most complicated and the most hazardous was the rendezvous, bringing them back up from the surface of the moon and having us meet at the proper time and place and join and go back home together.
So when you were alone, how did you occupy your mind to prevent yourself from obsessing with fear that you wouldn't be able to hook up again? Or was that not a problem?
I had a lot to do. Uh-huh. I had to, I had to get the newspaper in, put the cat out, make sure the fireplace was in good shape. I had a lot of housekeeping chores to do. The command module Columbia was a very large and complicated machine, and you have to keep paying attention to it, make sure all the temperatures, pressures, and so on are within limits, and that the thing is humming along in good shape. So that took a fair amount of my time. The rest of it, I'd have to say, I really enjoyed it. It was wonderful to have an occasional break from the constant chatter on the radio and get off behind the moon in the utter and complete silence of being the only human being on that side of that planet.
And this is the dark side, the side we don't see from Earth?
Yeah, it's the far side, the back side. Sometimes it's dark, sometimes it's light. It depends on the angle to the sun. But regardless of light or dark, it's utterly quiet, completely serene. I knew that over on the other side there were 3 billion on that funny-looking little planet out there and two on the surface of the moon. But where I was, that was all, just me.
My guest is astronaut Michael Collins. He was the command module pilot on the Apollo 11 mission when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. After leaving the space program, he was the director of the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum. He's just written a new history of the U.S. space program called Liftoff. How did you know that it was going to work, that you were going to be able to meet up and return together? I mean, when was that moment when you knew this is it, we've made it, we've made it?
Well, I did not know. I was worried about it. It's the rendezvous process is a relatively straightforward one, provided everything goes exactly right. But if, for example, they don't take off from the moon on time, if they're late by a few seconds or a minute, then all kinds of bad things start happening, and you have to change your entire strategy for bringing the two vehicles together. Likewise, if their gyros, let's say, their gyroscopes were tilted a little bit and they went up into some kind of a lopsided orbit, I might be able to go get them and I might not. I had some extra fuel on board, but it's very costly of fuel to change your orbit much, especially to change the direction of your orbit. And so there were just a lot of unknowns, in my mind at least, and therefore I was... pleased beyond measure to see them coming like right down the center line of the highway below me. I could see that from my computer and from the information coming from their radar that things were going well. And as they got closer and closer, I started feeling better and better and more confident that we were going to carry the whole thing off.
You wrote that when they returned, you wanted to give Buzz a big smooch on the forehead, and then you were too embarrassed, so you just shook his hand.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to greet him like a parent might greet an errant child who'd been out late, and you're so worried about where they are, but when they finally appear, you're just delighted. You give them a big hug.
So did you want to hear all about it when they got back in?
Yes, we had a lot of things to talk over, but not much time, because then that's a really busy period there. You have to transfer all their equipment back into the command module, get rid of Old Eagle, come swinging around the moon, and at exactly the right time, you have to ignite your rocket motor to break the bond of lunar gravity and to establish yourself on a trajectory that's going to come slicing into the Earth's atmosphere a couple of days later, slicing into the atmosphere at exactly the right angle.
You know, all of us got to see the moonwalk on television. Did you get to see any of it on a monitor while you were in space?
No, I had no... I had no way of seeing what was going on. I could talk to them. I had two different ways of talking to them while they were on the surface. One was when I was overhead, I could speak to them directly for a couple of minutes. And then when I went over the horizon, their horizon, I could talk to them by relay back to Earth. I could say something to the Earth, and then my voice would be bounced back to them on the surface. For the rest of the time, when I was behind the moon, I wasn't talking to anybody, nobody there.
It was interesting to me when you came back down to Earth and you landed in the water.
Yes.
The capsule was upside down for a while.
Yes.
And you had to be careful that you didn't get sick and throw up. Because what would the dangers have been if one of you had gotten sick in the suit you were wearing?
Well, they were worried about our bringing germs back from the moon, and we were immediately put into a quarantine. First, we were in a small container aboard the aircraft carrier, and then that container was flown by airplane back to Houston, and we were put into a quarantine laboratory there. So the point was, whatever germs we brought with us, and we, in fact, brought nothing strange from the moon, but had we brought any germs with us, it was very important that we keep those germs locked up inside that suit with us, so that if we'd had to unzip the suit and get ill, the possibility existed we might contaminate our home planet here.
Boy, it would really be a hypochondriac's delight to come back from from a moon voyage and then imagine yourself coming down with disease no Earth person has ever even heard of yet.
Well, we thought the chances of that were extraordinarily remote. Neil used to try to explain it by saying if you multiply a very, very small number, and that is the chances of our bringing any microbes back, against a gigantically large number, and that is the consequence of infecting the planet. What do you get? I don't know. You get a finite entity that's big enough to worry about, I guess.
I want to ask you about another really momentous space accomplishment in your life, and that was in July of 1966, when you were, I think, the first person in space to leave the vehicle and make contact with another space vehicle. Is that right?
Yes, that was a spacewalk leaving Gemini number 10, and floating over to an Agena, another unmanned vehicle that had been left in orbit, and retrieving from that Agena an experiment package and then bringing it back to the Gemini. And that was a little strange and a little bit different, and that's not something that you can quite choreograph like you can other parts of space. You just sort of have to see how it goes as it goes. And I had a few problems. I was trailing this umbilical cord, and there were loose pieces of metal flapping off the end of the Agena, and I was afraid that the cord was going to get entangled with the Agena, and that I was going to get wound up in a horrible mess, a ball connecting these two spacecraft. And poor old John Young, who was back in the Gemini, would have no choice but to snip my umbilical cord and leave me up there. And so it was a little tense for a while.
When you left the capsule for the spacewalk,
mm-hmm.
did you have to just kind of jump the way a lot of us jump into deep water for the very first time, thinking, well, I hope I float. This is it. Gotta go.
What happened is the first time John maneuvered the Gemini under the end of the Agena, and we were about, I guess, 10 or 12 feet away from it, and I gave a little tiny nudge. I didn't want to get going too fast, and I floated up and almost missed the thing, but I barely snagged it. But then as I was going hand over hand around to where the experiment package was, I fell off. And so I had to reel myself in on the umbilical and come back into the Gemini cockpit and then try again a second time. And the second time I had, instead of just pushing off, I had a little gun, it was called, where I could squirt out nitrogen gas and propel myself. So I aimed the gun right at the tip of the Agena and started squirting gas, and then I just kind of slowly rose up out of the cockpit and floated over to it and grabbed it once again.
Wow. I really want to hear what it looked like, but before we hear that, we're going to have to take a short break. My guest is astronaut Michael Collins, and he was the command module pilot on the Apollo 11 mission when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. He's just written a history of the American space program. It's called Liftoff. We'll talk more in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Astronaut Michael Collins is my guest, author of the new book, Liftoff, the story of America's adventure in space. Well, I think if there's any experience in the universe that could really make you think about how small each person is compared to the universe itself, it would be your experience walking in space like that. Did you think about that at the time, or were you too preoccupied to think about it?
No, actually, during that Gemini flight in Earth orbit, we were really busy. We were working about 16 to 18 hours a day, and we were overloaded. During the flight of Apollo 11 to the moon, I did have a chance to look back and give it some thought. If you look at the Earth as it is from the moon, first you find it's a tiny little thing. Once you locate it, you may look out all your spacecraft windows and not see it at all. But once you swing around and it comes into view, you're startled by how tiny it is. It's about the size of your thumbnail if you hold your arm out in front of you. And it's very, very bright, very, very shiny. The sunlight bounces off it. It's almost like a small headlight out there. Blue and white, primarily the blue of the water, the white of the clouds. You do see some land, but your primary impression is a little blue and white marble, and no sign of human beings, no sign of any habitation. The overriding impression I got was one, oddly enough, of fragility. I mean, I've walked the surface of this planet all my life. I know it's rock solid, but from space it appears to be very, very fragile. And if we think about that view, it's an accurate one. Our little planet here, with its very thin atmosphere, is a fragile entity, and it makes you want to really nurture it and protect it once you've seen it from outer space.
When you were doing your spacewalk, what could you actually see?
Oh, you can see wonderfully well. You have the whole world at your feet. Come roaring in over the Pacific Ocean. You can see in one glance all the way from Alaska to Baja California. You go across the United States in something like 6 minutes, and if you miss something, not to worry, you'll be back again in another 90 minutes and get a second look at it. This is true when you're inside the spacecraft peering out a small porthole. It's even more true when you're outside and you got this wide-angle view of the whole world below you.
I'll tell you something I don't understand, and I don't know if you could explain it in lay terms, but when you're out dangling from this umbilical cord in space attached to a spacecraft, the spacecraft is speeding around in orbit. How do you keep up a relative speed with the spacecraft?
Oh, gee, that's hard to explain. It's sort of like driving down the highway at 55 miles an hour in your station wagon, and you've got the kids in the back seat, and one of the kids jumps up off the seat, that kid comes down in the same spot. It doesn't come down somewhere else because the car has moved out from under him while he was up in the air. You see what I mean? The car is going 55 miles an hour. The kid's going 55 miles an hour, but the kid bounces up and down, lands in the same spot in the car because he's going 0 miles an hour relative to the car. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does, except that you're outside of the car, so to speak, at this
point. All right, make it a convertible then, instead of
right,
a station
okay.
wagon.
Got it. Okay. I want to quote an astronaut who you quote in your book, Joe Kerwin. He says, "You carry with you your own body-oriented world in which up is over your head, down is below your feet, and you take this world around with you wherever you go." What does that mean to you? In space?
Well, what he's talking about is getting disoriented, where all of a sudden you say, whoops, I'm upside down. And there was a lot of debate, especially aboard a space station like Skylab, and that's where Joe flew. There was a lot of debate about should you make all the dials and gadgets read, you know, which way? I mean, which way's up? But you can kind of, and what Joe is saying, well, up as we know it here on the ground, really up means away from the center of the Earth. When you don't think about it that way, but that's really what our up is. Down is toward the center of the Earth. Up is away from the center of the Earth. And what Joe is saying, that doesn't matter so much anymore. You take your own little up-down orientation with you, and you kind of think of things relative to your own body and its position rather than where the center of the Earth happens to be.
Do you think that most astronauts who've gone as far away from their home planet as you have are changed very much by that experience? It seems like the kind of experience that would lead you to undergo either a religious conversion or to come back thinking about things in ways you've never thought about it before, or that you might be very depressed afterwards because nothing could ever measure up to the climactic experience of walking on or orbiting the moon?
Well, I think all of those elements you mentioned are certainly there, Terry. I think I can only speak for myself, and in my case, they were there, they are there, but they're relatively small things. I think I'm still fundamentally the same person that I was before I flew in space. I on the side of Union Station in Washington, D.C., there's an inscription carved in the stone that says, "He who would bring back the wealth of the Indies must carry the wealth of the Indies with him." I think you pretty much come back the same person that you went up. Some sensations, some ideas are certainly heightened. You see things that will remain with you all your life. I've been privileged to see things that that earthbound people will never see, and I won't forget those things. But I think I'm probably fundamentally the same person I was before.
Did the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger shake your confidence in the space program?
No, not at all. If someone had told me when I first entered the space program back in the 60s that we would go for 20-some years without anyone getting killed riding a rocket, I would have told that person they were hopelessly optimistic and incredibly naive. Something like that just had to happen sooner or later. Look at that all-time favorite American gadget, the automobile. We make automobiles as safe as we can. We put a lot of sound engineering into them. We have a lot of rules and regulations about their use. We have to get them inspected for safety. We're supposed to drive them 55 miles an hour. Despite all that, we still kill 45,000 Americans every year on the highway. Now, with that as a background, how can we suddenly expect a different machine, much more powerful, much more complex, to be perfect? We really can't. I mean, I think we've asked too much of NASA, we've asked too much of the space program to judge it against a standard of perfection. People are people. They're going to make mistakes. NASA made some mistakes. We saw it in the death of 7 people aboard the Challenger. But I don't know. Progress doesn't come free or easy.
What do you think the next big goal for the space program should be?
Well, I'd like to see it be Mars. I think Mars is the most fascinating place out there. I think some day, some year, some century, people will have the option of either living here or living somewhere else out in the solar system. And if you believe that, then Mars clearly is the next logical step in that direction. It's a fascinating place. It's almost a sister planet, yet it's one that's totally different from Earth. The question is, for example, at one point in its history, Mars had an abundance of water, enough water to carve out deep channels twice as deep as the Grand Canyon. And now that water has evaporated and gone. Why? What was that process? What does it mean for the future of this planet? I mean, we're starting now to see ozone holes over the South Pole. Do you suppose once in Mars's history they went through a similar kind of thing? Why did these two planets turn out to be so different when they started out to be quite similar to each other?
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I've enjoyed it.
My guest has been astronaut Michael Collins, and he piloted the command module during the Apollo 11 flight when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. Collins' new book is titled Liftoff, and it's a history of the U.S. space program. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with journalist Paul Eddy. As a reporter for the Sunday Times of London, he investigated the Colombian cocaine cartel and the route of drugs from Latin America to Miami. His new book is titled Cocaine Wars. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Baseball's been compared to ballet, to war, to poetry. Coming up, Ron Shelton talks about how baseball is like making a movie. Shelton spent 5 years in the minor leagues. He also wrote and directed the new film Bull Durham. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews 3 albums from women rockers who don't fit any stereotypes. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the new Disney-Spielberg collaboration in which actors co-star with cartoon characters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. One of the officials connected to the Pentagon procurement scandal is talking to federal prosecutors, and a second official is said to be considering such a move. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
James Gaines, a deputy assistant Navy secretary whose office was searched and phone tapped by Justice Department investigators, has begun cooperating with prosecutors. Another Pentagon official, Victor Cohen, is reportedly also considering cooperating in the investigation. Gaines is said to be the principal supplier of classified Pentagon documents to Melvin Paisley, formerly an assistant secretary of the Navy and for a time Gaines' boss. Asked about the scandal at the White House today, President Reagan said he's asked for an update on the investigation, but did not say when he'd receive the report. Meanwhile, James Godwin, brought in to overhaul the Pentagon procurement system by former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, said he quit his job last fall because Weinberger and the president wouldn't follow his recommendations. Godwin calls the procurement system a national crisis, as bad for the country as drug trafficking and the AIDS epidemic. I'm Brian Naylor in Washington.
The House Ethics Committee met again today on the investigation into charges against House Speaker Jim Wright. Although the committee has not announced its plan to hire outside counsel to conduct the inquiry, sources have told NPR that lawyers are already being interviewed for the job. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
At the last meeting of the Ethics Committee, the members decided to bring in someone from the outside to look at the charges against House Speaker Jim Wright. But the committee wanted to wait until someone had agreed to the job before making that announcement. So far, no one has. That's what Ethics Committee members learned in a closed-door meeting today. The chairman and highest-ranking Republican on the committee told their colleagues that they've been putting in long hours looking for a lawyer to take on the job of investigating the Speaker of the House of Representatives, but that no one is leaping at the opportunity. Problems arise for many prominent lawyers because they or their firms are involved in cases before the Congress that could be considered a conflict of interest. And in looking for a person of stature, it's hard to find someone who has the time for the Ethics Committee job.
NPR's Cokie Roberts at the Capitol. Agriculture Secretary Richard Ling told Midwestern governors today that the federal government will expand the crop insurance and disaster loan programs to help farmers cope with the drought. 10 governors of Midwestern states opened their conference in Chicago today. Governor George Sinner of North Dakota said 70% of his state's grain crop has been lost. Hosting Governor James Thompson said Illinois soybean and corn crops could all be lost if there is not substantial rain in the next 30 days. And Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson said the situation is serious in his state as well.
The dairy situation is quite serious because we feel that 80% of the farmers in Wisconsin will not have, at this point in time, if no more rain comes, will have enough food stuff, enough hay, enough corn silage to feed their cattle. There'll have to be some culling, and that is very serious.
Secretary Ling said he would meet with President Reagan tomorrow morning to update him on the drought. The government announced today that the U.S. economy grew a 3.6% annual rate. Today figures are a revision of the earlier 3.9% estimate for first quarter growth. The GNP rate was revised downward to reflect lower than previously estimated consumer and government spending. Despite this downward revision, economists said the rate of growth is still strong, and today at the White House they predicted that the economy would grow at a 3% rate for the rest of the year. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 4 points to close at 2141.29. Declines led advances 6-5 on trading of 186 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of three new albums featuring female singers he believes deserve more recognition. This is Jane Wiedlin singing Inside a Dream from her album Fur.
There's a certain amount of stir in the rock press these days about the sudden profusion of women making vital, innovative music. To some extent, this attention is obviously sexist. You don't read too many articles that lump together a new batch of male singers out there. But it's undeniably true that what critics and fans are noticing is a number of women working in idiosyncratic styles. Small but significant triumphs occur as women reject female rock stereotypes, the sex bomb hard rocker, the frail song poet, the bluesy good time gal. The names that are being most widely bandied about are performers such as Tracy Chapman, Sinead O'Connor, and especially Tony Childs, who was the recipient of an inadvertently hilarious mash note from Jay Cox in Time magazine recently. All of these women have their strong points, to be sure, but there are other singers around right now who could use a bit more attention. I'm thinking of acts as various as Jane Wiedlin, a former member of the Go-Go's who recently put out her second solo album. There's the female rapper named MC Light, and a band from Iceland called the Sugar Cubes, whose most notable asset is the voice of lead singer Bjork. That was the Sugar Cubes from Iceland, whose new album, Life's Too Good, has just been released in America. It's clear that lead singer Bjork has been influenced by everyone from Susie and the Banshees to Olivia Newton-John. The group's lyrics have a dreamy surrealism that sounds all the more mysterious coming from her diving, swooping voice. By contrast, the rapper MC Light speaks in a calm, conversational tone. She had a big hit last year with a song called I Cram to Understand You, Sam. In it, the narrator spoke about her suspicions that her boyfriend was seeing someone else. The unsettling climax of the song occurred when she discovered that the secret he was trying to keep from her was that he was addicted to crack. On this song called Paper Thin, taken from the album Light as a Rock, MC Light talks about the emotional emptiness of much romantic speech.
When you say you love me, it doesn't matter. It goes into my head as just chit-chatter. You may think it's egotistical or just very free, but what you say, I take none of it seriously. And even if I did, I wouldn't tell you so. I'd let you pretend to read me, and then you'd know. Cause I hate when one attempts to analyze. In fact, I despise those who even try to look into my eyes to see what I am thinking. That dream is over. Your yacht is sinking. I tell all of you like I told all of them. What you say to me is just paper thin.
That's MC Light. It seems to me that one of the most neglected pop albums of the year is Jane Wiedlin's Fur. Although the album's first single, Rush Hour, is a top 20 hit, the album itself isn't selling especially well, which is a real shame, because working with producer Stephen Haig, Wiedlin has made one of the wittiest and most varied records I've heard in a while. Take, for example, the title song, a bouncy pop number that, upon closer inspection, turns out to be an impassioned plea to women to stop wearing fur coats. It's an animal rights song as it might have been sung by a cross between Dusty Springfield and Petula Clark. What common themes are to be extracted from these distinctive performers? None, I'm happy to say. This stuff has nothing to do with trends or movements, and perhaps appropriate words like ambition and independence are too obvious to be of much use. The point, if there is one, is simply that this music deserves to be heard more often, by as many people as possible, because the best of it will stretch anyone's conception of what rock and roll is supposed to encompass.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's Bjork from the Sugar Cubes singing Birthday. This is Fresh Air. Five years of playing minor league baseball never got Ron Shelton into the majors, but 17 years later, the experience helped him make a hit film. Shelton wrote and directed Bull Durham, about a team in the Carolina League. Shelton played second base in the Baltimore Orioles farm system. He batted .260 for Rochester during his last year. I asked Ron Shelton how serious he was about baseball.
I was very serious. I'm serious about any career I'm involved in. I lived for baseball from the time I was a small boy. Probably went to college because of sports, and couldn't imagine getting through a week without having several games to play.
You played second base, right?
I played second base professionally, shortstop in college, and you can't play this game. It's a very hard game, and you can't play it at the professional level without a total commitment. So when I quit playing at the age of 25, it was not taken lightly. It was the end of a dream.
When you played, were you good?
Of course. Professional, you don't sign out of high school or college unless you're good enough that some major league team doesn't invest money in your development and in the future. You are an investment. It's a business. I was good enough to play to make my living at the sport for several years.
Now, Bull Durham is about a veteran minor league catcher who's really intelligent but is not a natural talent, and he has to train. I mean, he's not a brilliant natural talent, and he has to train a young pitcher who's a natural as far as his arms goes, but he's also kind of a dope. And I was wondering if you ever experienced that kind of frustration of breaking in someone who wasn't nearly as smart, as perceptive as you were, but had more natural talent.
No, but I would like to correct that I'm not. The Crash Davis, Kevin Costner character, is not me and is not autobiographical. I think there's a little me in Crash, and there's a little me in Nuke, the kid, and there's a little me in Annie, the woman. The setup of the movie is kind of an archetypal, classic, even conventional, young player, old player, woman in between. And in terms of verisimilitude, I frequently was on teams in the minor leagues where a veteran player would be sent down to help a young player and would do it reluctantly, but because they are professional, after all, would do it the best they could. So I never was involved in that exact situation, but I saw it around me a lot.
When you were in the minor leagues, did you read more than the other players?
I read more than some. I probably read different things, that's all. And ball players, I think, have a reputation for being sort of dumb and uneducated that's really outdated. In the 20s and 30s, ball players were uneducated and frequently were dropouts and were working class immigrants, a lot of Polish ball players and, of course, the Irish ball players. And I think that's changed a lot. Ball players now frequently go to college, and whether you go to college or not, I think that they're no more or less educated than almost any other working class environment.
Now, you said that there's part of you in the Crash Davis character, and I wonder if this is part of it. When he's up at bat, he's always thinking to himself that he has to stop thinking, and that thinking gets in the way of actually playing, of actually batting anyways. Did you have to turn off thinking when you were at bat?
That part is true, yes. I think all ballplayers tend to think too much. All athletes tend to think too much, and I think I tend to think too much. And as a writer and director, I have to give myself that instruction. Don't think too much. You prepare for what you're doing, whether it's to make a movie or to play a baseball game or to run a talk show or be a journalist, and then once you're in the middle of it, you have to submit to the rhythms and the instincts and the intuitions of the moment. And in that's, I suppose, where the Zen aspects of athletic competition comes up. You have to use your brain to not use your brain.
Did you expect to get into the majors when you were playing?
You always believe that it's possible, and that keeps you going. Expectations are crazy. I never expected to be able to direct a film. Uh-huh. I never expected I'd sell a script. I didn't think any film I wanted to make or that I wrote would anybody ever want to invest money in, but I kept doing it because I believed in the process. So, yes, I thought I was good enough to make the big leagues, and I thought I was good enough to write scripts to make into movies, but that's not why you do it. You do it because you believe in the game, you believe in storytelling, you believe in baseball, whatever it is. You believe in journalism.
What did you leave baseball?
The low and away slider ate me up. I mean, that's the glib answer, but it's not entirely untrue. I had trouble hitting the breaking ball away. At the end of my 5 years, I was learning to hit the ball to right field, which all good hitters have to be able to do. But beyond that, I'd made a commitment to play 5 years professionally, and if I wasn't in the major leagues, I was going to quit because I didn't want to turn into the Kevin Costner character who's been 12 years in the minors. And I literally quit in 1972 when the first baseball strike hit. And I did not think about baseball until many years later when I did this movie.
You know, in your movie, you get the sense that for a lot of people, life after the minor leagues is going to mean a job at Sears or opening a small pool hall or a small bar. You managed to leave the minors and eventually get into filmmaking. How did you do it?
A long story that is pretty boring and would take hours. In effect, I was a movie nut from baseball days on. I would go to every movie. You know, you go into town for a six-day road trip, I'd go to the different show every day in the multiplex theater, whether it was a G-rated or X-rated. I just became addicted to movies. And along the way, I was writing largely unpublishable fiction, occasionally getting a short story in some obscure journal that nobody's ever heard of. And about 9 years ago, like everybody else in Los Angeles, I said, I can do that. And I sat down and wrote a screenplay and was shocked to find out that people would actually pay me to do this. And it's sort of been, if you can't make a living playing baseball, this is the next best thing. I'm delighted that I can make my living doing this because I never feel I have any clue about where the pulse of the American public is.
But you seem to have a finger on it nevertheless.
I never expect to make a big hit, much less a summer hit. I'm just trying to tell a story and get enough money together to make it. And that happened in Bull Durham. And the fact that it's struck some chord is thrilling. You don't expect that, though.
You've said that after you left the minor leagues, you didn't pick up a bat until actually filming Bull Durham.
I meant by that I'd go to a couple of ball games a year, but I didn't play. Mm-hmm. I'd play basketball. I never played baseball. I couldn't play it at a softball level, at a picnic level. I did have too much respect for having played it at a fairly high level, and I couldn't goof around with the game. In that sense, I suppose I still was clinging to something, and in this movie, exercised a few demons. I mean, it certainly was a cathartic experience of, all right, I didn't make the big leagues, but here's a movie that belongs in the big leagues, you know? And I think with me, I just needed to clear my head and get into other parts of my life before I could go back and investigate those memories.
Has the making of Bull Durham united two parts of your life, the baseball part and the movie part, in a way that you thought they might never come together?
I don't think those were two parts of my life. Baseball was, it was a game and an occupation and a love, but I don't think that, there's too many fragmented parts of my life to be so easily united by a movie.
Do you find now that a lot of people in the movie world know your baseball background, that a lot of men envy you for having, in a way, lived out their fantasy by having spent a few years in the minor leagues? And if so, I'm wondering if it ever felt to you like living out a fantasy, or if you were too busy trying to play the game well to think of it in those terms.
No, it's exactly that. You don't think you're living out a fantasy when you're playing baseball. Neither do you wax romantic or poetic or get lyrical and talk about mythology and backlight and all that. When you're playing baseball, you're trying to get a hit. You're trying to win the game. You're trying to make the play at second base. You're trying to make your living, and it's a high-pressure, very intense world. One only gets poetic when you get a lot of distance and start to get old. At least that's what I find.
On the next Fresh Air, Ron Shelton will discuss the making of Bull Durham, which he wrote and directed.
It's right by the home plate. Don't look. Don't look.
Hey, what's going on?
You're breathing through the wrong friggin' eyelid again, dude.
Shut up.
Excuse me.
Guys, I got a game to pitch here.
Hey, you guys. Don't throw me anything. My girlfriend put a curse on my glove.
I'll take the hex off the friggin' glove. Give me the glove.
Well, then you gotta cut the head off a live rooster.
Excuse
me. What the hell's going on out here?
Well, Nuke's scared because his eyelids are jammed and his old man's here. We need a live, rooster? We need a live rooster to take the curse off Jose's glove, and nobody seems to know what to get Millie or Jimmy for their wedding present. Is that about right?
That's right.
We're dealing with a lot of stuff.
Okay, well, candlesticks always make a nice gift, and maybe you can find out where she's registered, maybe a place setting or maybe a silverware pedestal. Okay, let's get to it.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we have a report tonight on the fact that the FBI is investigating the role of Governor Dukakis and some senior members of his staff in the selection of a site for a prison in Massachusetts. Investigators are trying to determine whether inside information was given to the owners of the land before it was selected to be the site for this prison. Also, a look tonight at the upcoming Special Communist Party Congress in the Soviet Union. And from the International Arts Festival in New York, how allegory figures into the works of two theater companies, one from Poland, the other from Indonesia. In both societies, free expression is suspect.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's hard to miss Roger Rabbit this week. He's on the cover of Newsweek and has been all over the media. Roger Rabbit is a cartoon character who co-stars with Bob Hoskins in a new film called Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Stephen Schiff has this review.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit begins with a cartoon, a hectic, beautifully drawn, insanely violent cartoon of the sort Warner Brothers used to make, starring Bugs Bunny or Daffy Duck. A character named Roger Rabbit, who wears a garish bow tie and talks with a sputtering lisp, is trying to protect a mischievous baby from doing itself harm when suddenly the cartoon stops. We hear a voice yell, "Cut! Cut!" and a real, live-action human movie director walks onto the scene, scolding the rabbit for blowing his lines, while the cartoon baby stalks off into the real world of lights and cameras, yelling in a deep voice, "I'll be in my trailer." At which point my own eyeballs went boing. You've seen animation combined with live action in movies like Mary Poppins and Song of the South, but I promise you, you have never seen anything remotely like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. The director, Robert Zemeckis, and an animation team led by Richard Williams have avoided the flat, brightly lit phoniness such attempts usually entail. They've created three-dimensional animated characters who move through the world as convincingly as real actors do, and the camera zips and cranes and stretches with them. It's a boggling feat, a development so historic and viscerally exciting that it almost makes you forget that the movie they're inhabiting isn't terribly good. The filmmakers have imagined a Hollywood of the 40s in which cartoon characters like Betty Boop, Mickey Mouse, Tweety Pie, and all the rest are played by creatures called Toons. They're as alive as you or me, but they're endowed with peculiar powers. For instance, the ability to make stars float around their heads when refrigerators are dropped on them. When the famous Roger Rabbit is framed for murder, he turns to the down-and-out human detective Eddie Valiant, played by Bob Hoskins, for protection. But what's in it for Valiant isn't always clear. When a gang of murderous cartoon weasels comes looking for Roger, Valiant hides the squooey wabbit and isn't entirely happy with the thanks he gets.
Search the place, boys, and leave no stone unturned. As for you, Valiant, step out of line and we'll hang you and your laundry out to dry. Come on, boys, let's am spray.
They're gone.
Gee, Pathetti, I was thrilled. You saved my life. How can I ever repay you?
For starters, don't ever kiss me again.
The movie makers have been intelligent enough to know that their amazing technical feat alone is not enough to sustain our interest. They throw in a subplot about the decay of Los Angeles, for instance, that's reminiscent of Chinatown. And the way they depict the treatment of the Toons provides a complex metaphor for racial discrimination in and out of the entertainment industry. Unfortunately, all of this is woven into the sort of tired gumshoe parody that we've seen thousands of times before. And when the script isn't tossing around jokes about animation, it feels feeble and wan. Who Framed Roger Rabbit knocks your socks off one minute and practically leaves you snoozing the next. But I wouldn't have missed it for the world. Seeing it made me feel the way those lucky moviegoers must have felt in 1927, when they went to see what they thought would be a silent movie called The Jazz Singer, and suddenly its star, Al Jolson, opened his mouth and said, "You ain't heard nothing yet."
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Rush Air. Most films about baseball have been real flops, but the summer hit Bull Durham is an exception. Next time, part two of my interview with Ron Shelton, who wrote and directed the film. He'll describe how he translated his minor league career to the screen. Michael Doucette returns with two other members of the Cajun band Beau Soleil to perform a few songs. And while few black women comics have become stars, Angela Scott is not discouraged. Our critic at large, Laurie Stone, has a profile. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Ed Doherty. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Laura DeFilippo, Dan Cornwell, and Camilla Herrera. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.